Amen. Good morning, church. It's good. It's good. I already prayed for it, but I cannot imagine what it's like to live in Houston right now. Sheer size and scope of what we have watched and heard about. I saw a Walmart ad that was really cool during the Squeaker football game last night, the Oregon Ducks winning barely. Okay, that was a joke, everybody. They almost hit 100 in football. But I was watching this ad, and it was an ad by Walmart, and it said, together with you, or something like this, we've raised and sent $25 million to Texas. And I thought, good for them. Good for them. And then I thought, how far from meeting the need is that? And I didn't do the math, but it's a staggering, literally drop in the bucket to the need that's there in Houston. So there's hard stuff. There's difficulty there. Sunshine could not come quick enough for Houstonians, right? And stay for a very long time. But then I got thinking at home, right here in Oregon. No more at home, right here in this room. People like you and me, how do we define difficult? And I was tempted to give you scenarios or examples, and I could, and you would go, maybe it might hit where you're at, or close, and you'd call it yours. But I wanted to have you right now, everybody, and I'll know if you do this. I want you to reach for a pen near you, okay? All right. Some of you are not. Some of you are trying to fake me out. You're looking at me and reaching at the same time. That's good. That's okay. And now reach for the outline. It's not really an outline. It's a page for you to take notes. I'm still watching every one of you right now. Okay? And here's what I want you to do. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to write something in just somewhere at the top of your notes. Okay? And it would finish this sentence. My biggest burden that I now, right now, need strength and courage to face is. Ready? And look at my watch. It's big letters. I know how 30 seconds looks, okay? So ready? Go. My biggest challenge, my biggest burden, where I need strength and courage to face it is. Gotcha. All right. Some of you wrote more than one. Some of you wrote something for someone you know. Maybe for you, you're like, man, I have to reach far to find one. I'm living the dream. Good. Good for you. This is going to work for you someday, though. Promise. Sorry to predict that, but it's the hurricane or fire is going to hit you, too, and that's true of all of us. So, but here's the deal. If it's not you today, and it is someone you know today, then you have a job to do when you leave here today. You get to go and reach out to them and tell them truth. Because if God has his way, as a result of what we're going to hear from him today, every single one of us, and them too, will have the courage and strength that they need to face whatever it is that they're facing. All right? So let's go on a journey together. Take a look back with me. Join me for just a kind of imaginary journey to Israel in the ancient times. For 40 years, they had wandered in the wilderness under Moses, their leader. They had left Egypt. They were set free. And for 40 years, they zigged and they zagged in a, I love this word, circuitous way, which is the opposite of straight. So, If you live in a neighborhood where you're like, you get lost and you've lived there 20 years because there's this road goes that, what happened, you know, all this stuff. Circuitous goes like that. And that's what the wanderings, that's why the word wanderings is used very often to describe these people who were journeying to a land that they were promised, a.k.a. Israel, the promised land. And so they journeyed this way to this little tiny, compared to Egypt, a postage stamp, 150 miles long from top to bottom and 60 miles from side to side. That's what you're looking at. Does that sound a little bit like the Willamette Valley even? I mean, that's kind of roughly the size. It's not that huge. And they were journeying all these years to that. And God instructs Moses, the leader that he had picked, to take them to the land. He instructs these people, Moses, to select from the millions, that's how many were there, one person from each of the 12 tribes represented in this wandering, zigging and zagging. Okay, so there's 12 tribes, pick one from each tribe, bring them together, and your marching orders are very simple. I want you to go into the land, and I want you to scout out, you ready for this? Your new home. So all of this is told in Numbers chapter 13. If you're interested, you could turn there and actually see with your own eyes. But when they return, so he gathers 12 of them from the 12 tribes. They go out, and when they return from their 6 weeks spy mission, which, by the way, covered 500 miles, they came in from the south, and they wound their way all the way up to what the New Testament would call Sidon and Tyre, up in what's present-day Lebanon, way up in the north. Okay, so they're coming in from the south, and they wiggle and find and take notes, and you know, their iPhones were going crazy getting all this data and info because they got to come back and deliver it, and they were also getting some samples of the bounty of this new place that's going to be their home. So 6 weeks goes by, and they come back to report what they saw, and to say the least, their report was mixed. Let's break into the story at verse 25 in Numbers chapter 13. At the end of 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. It's down south where they began this odyssey, this spy mission. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. This is an ancient version of show and tell. Okay, you with me? All right, most of the kids that would be hearing me would say, yeah, I like that. All right, so they're showing and they're sharing what they saw and experienced. Verse 27, they gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it, just like you said, does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit, and they reveal what they had picked up some parts along the way. But the people who live there are powerful. Do you sense the tone change already? The cities, they're fortified, and they're huge. They're very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. It's understood that Goliath, for example, was from that lineage. And if you were to go all the way back to Genesis chapter 6, there's another group of giants known as the Nephilim. It's believed this is all part of these supersized Goliath-like people. We saw them, came the report. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country. There's a whole bunch of them. And the Canaanites live near the sea along the Jordan. So out by the Mediterranean Sea and inland in the valley, as it were, by the Jordan. I love verse 30. I love it. And maybe this is what you're supposed to be in moments like this. Then Caleb silence the people before Moses. Watch my hands. This is what, if you're all going, yeah, and we saw, and then, oh man, there's lots of them. They're huge, man. And Caleb stands up and goes, whoa, shh. He does what we do to shut. Okay? He silences the people before Moses and said, we should go up and take possession of the land. No problem. We can do it. Definitely. Presumably, count me in. That didn't land so well. Next verse. But the men who had gone up with him said, "You're cracked, Caleb. It gets worse. We can't attack those people. They're stronger than who we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. So they weren't just calling him out in that moment in front of everybody, but they start spreading further false information. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak came from the Nephilim, and we seemed like grasshoppers in their eyes. And we looked the same to them. All of us seemed small and insignificant and frankly intimidated by the size of that." Are we coming close to home so far? We're not done. Chapter 14. "That night, all the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud." In other words, the 10 that talked that way had spread their poison throughout their ranks. And they groaned and moaned and wept aloud. "And all Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, 'If only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children, they're going to be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to just go back to Egypt?' They said to each other, 'We should choose a new leader.'" There's anarchy in the wind. "And go back to Egypt." And look at the reaction from Moses and Aaron. They fall face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes, an ancient, a sort of a poverty of spirit, a brokenness, a nonverbal, "This is horrible." You know, we would say beating our chest or weeping out loud. They tear their clothes. They say to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good, just as we heard it would be. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and he will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of that land, because we," is this great, "we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." So I read it with emphasis to help you see that clearly Joshua, or he was named, and Caleb, those two, are in the minority report as it came to this scouting retelling. What did you see? What was your impressions? And one can only imagine, after that powerful speech, and hopefully I read it with the right kind of emphasis, how verse 10 landed. We ended at verse 9. Look what happened. The whole assembly talked about stoning them. In other words, it didn't land very well. Everybody said, "You know what? You guys are missing it. And I think the quickest way back to where we should be is to kill both of you." God watched all this, took note of everything he heard, and he had had it with these people. His conclusion is, my paraphrase, "Stand back, I'm going to smoke them all, and we're going to start over. We're going to start this whole game over, and we got basically four of you, Joshua, Caleb, Moses, Aaron, not a whole bunch of others that are named here in a favorable way." His immediate plans to destroy the people. Look down at, the next verse, verse 11. "The Lord said to Moses, 'How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the signs I have performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a new nation, a great nation, greater and stronger than they.'" In other words, I'm going to replace this bunch. Stand back and watch me do it. That's pretty strong words. Powerful words. But this is probably just one of the many reasons why Moses stands as the most humble leader in history, Numbers tells us. Look what Moses says to God. And I have to confess to you, if you're Moses in this moment, it would be awful tempting to go, okay, God, have at it. But look what he says in verse 13. Says to the Lord, Moses does, then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power, you brought these people out from among them. They're going to tell the inhabitants of this land about it. They've already heard that you, Lord, are with these people, and that you, Lord, have been seen face to face, and that your cloud stays over them, and that you go before them in a pillar of. I mean, you're all over these people, Lord. If you put all these people to death, verse 15, leaving none alive, the nations are going to make hay of that. They're going to have a field day with all of this, Lord. Look down at verse 19. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sins of your people, just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now. Let me stop for a second and tell you something that I hope you never get tired of hearing. You and I do things regularly that deserve this kind of judgment from a holy God. Okay? But praise God that he's the kind of God that says, okay, I won't do what I was going to do. Which makes him a forgiving and gracious God. Grace, by definition, means you deserve something but didn't get it. It was absolutely yours to get, and God went another way. Okay? Death is what results from sin, and death is, God has to make no apology to anybody. But because he's gracious, he finds a way to actually listen to a human's plea, Moses' plea. God, don't do this. Don't take out these people. It wasn't like God went, oh, wow, I had forgotten. This could be bad press out there in the world. Right? This is not God going, man, I lost my cool. Thank Mo. Appreciate you, dude. This was just God going, Moses, I'm going to let you tell out loud what's really in my heart. And sure enough, it unfolds that way. Let me just have you see how it ends here. Verse 26, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, how long will this wicked community grumble against me? I've heard the complaints of these grumbling Israelites, so tell them, as surely as I live, declares the Lord, I will do to you the very thing I heard you say. In this wilderness, your bodies will fall, every one of you 20 years old or more, who was counted in the census and who has grumbled against me. Not one of you will enter the land I swore with uplifted hand to make your home, except Caleb and Joshua. And they did. From this moment in time, after 40 years of time, those people in this zigzag wandering in the wilderness, one by one by one, everybody 20 years and older, perished in the wilderness. They got old and they died. They were gone. But another generation was coming up. All those under 20. And this entire adult population that should have led better than they led, gone. They passed away. The younger generation, by the way, that's all in verse, 22, I think? Not one of those who saw my glory and signs I performed in Egypt in the wilderness, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times and so on. They are gone. And this new nation, if you want to fast forward now, is all that's left. And I'm turning my page here to Joshua chapter 1, where we'll land the rest of this conversation. Joshua chapter 1, if you'll just flip forward, you will find in one chapter a group of this younger generation now grown up, 40 years older. Okay? So that means they're roughly 60 years and under by this point. Right? Does that make sense? You following my math? So they're all 20 and younger. They survived the wandering 40 years in the wilderness, and now they're adults. And now they are the nation. And they are standing on the eastern bank of the Jordan River in Joshua chapter 1. And Moses, by this time, is 40 years older and has just died. He too did not see the land. Not until, that is, the transfiguration in the New Testament. Cool. Moses was one of them that God said, here, you get to see the land. But here we go to Joshua chapter 1, and we find ourselves looking at a nation 40 years older. We look at Moses now gone, he's died, and Joshua and Caleb have spent 40 years, four decades in the shadow of Moses. If you've had a mentor that's made a difference in your life, it's likely that it didn't happen in a few months. It probably took years. And if you've been under that shadow of that person for any length of time, you know that you learned a lot. You witnessed a lot. And if you paid attention, you gained a lot. You're a gooder person for it. Okay? Just checking to see how many of you are ready for school this week, your grammar classes. So you're better for it because you watched, you took notes, you asked questions. You said of the Larry McCrackens in your life, hey, tell me how you did that. That worked out for you. I don't get it. Thankfully, he's my dad, so I can call him anytime, you know? And he explains, I'm a better man than you, Steve, so stick around. But you learn, you grow, and you watch. And that's what Joshua and Caleb had done. And now they come to this place, and they are quite literally, these are the first days out from under the shadow of Moses, because Moses is gone. So, may I insert something that's almost certain to be the case at this moment for Joshua? He's shaking in his boots. He's got 40 years, and he's paid attention, but Moses is gone. And he's shaking his boots. And in his own words, I want to draw attention to two of the great weights that he felt as he shares in his own words in real time what this moment was like as he stood in front of these people, now 1.5 million in size or more, poised to cross west through the Jordan River into this land flowing with milk and honey. We're 40 years later. Now you're with me, Joshua 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. This is what God said to him. By the way, Joshua wrote this, so you're getting this, all right? Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land that I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place you set your foot on, as I promised Moses long ago, 40 years ago. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon, from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, to the Mediterranean Sea, all the way to the west. And no one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. I was with Moses, so I will be with you, Joshua. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Verse 6, be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them. Be strong and very courageous, verse 7, because be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right nor to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips, meditating on it in your heart day and night, so that you will be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Let me stop reading and ask, show of hands, how many want to be prosperous and successful? Is kind of everybody? Okay. I'll bet the people went, I like that. I like that. Have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous? Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. So let's note the first of probably many, but a couple of weights that are weighing Joshua down at this moment. The first one comes right out of the gate in verse 2. Moses, my servant, is dead. This simple sentence is laced with loss. You got that phone call? If you haven't, you will. Hey, and the person reporting it has a quiver in their voice, or perhaps they're sobbing as they tell you, so-and-so's dead. It's a heavy hit in this moment. He and Moses were closer than brothers. They would be, after 40 years of Joshua walking around following him everywhere he went, they would be like a David and Jonathan. They were closer than brothers. Walked closely all of these years. They had been through the ups and the downs of leadership, and they did it back to back. So when Joshua hears that sort of sentence that will live on in his heart, that he will not forget where he was at that moment, it's a tremor that he's faced with. Even though Josh had learned a lot under Moses, I am absolutely certain he could carry on competently, but this was now not theoretical. Hey, Moses, someday when you... Hey, Moses, I know it's hard to hear me at this point in your life. He was that old. But can you give me a little hint of what you think I should do here? The what would Moses do is over. You can't go to Moses. This was real stuff. And grief is great when it's about losing someone that you've admired so much and counted on just as much. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? A large part of my counseling ministry is with people who have suffered loss. Just this week, I've had losses that I won't tell you about because I don't want to reveal anything, but losses in people that cover the gamut, from jobs to a pet. It's loss. It's real. They're heartbroken, and everything in between. That's just normal life. And you know, one of my sort of, I knew this early on in ministry, I'd have to get good at understanding grief. And so I studied a lot about it, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others. And I figured out, but one of the most immediate pieces of counsel I give is, listen, declare a moratorium on any major decisions for up to 2 years. And there's wisdom behind those words, because you just got hit by something approaching a sneaker wave or a tsunami somewhere in there, and you got decked, you got leveled, and you're churning in the sand, and you are suffering a heartbreak. And it's right now that you need to just stay steady. You don't need to flip out or freak out and do something rash. You just need to be stable. So, so Joshua is hearing this, and he's suffering grief. Amazingly, verse 6 tells us a second wait, and he didn't have a month or a year or two. He hears next, and probably the most difficult, "You will lead these people," is what he heard. He says, "Be strong and courageous, but you will lead these people." If you think of those words right there, put yourself where Joshua is. Hey, Joshua, be strong and courageous, because you're going to lead these people. Now, if you think Joshua went, "Yes, all right, gleeful, my moment's finally come, it's my turn," then either you've never led, or you've long forgotten what it's like to bear the weight of leading. I could tell you a story about a man that gets a call in the middle of the night, a good friend of ours in Southern Cal, and he's told that his partner in business just slammed his private airplane into Mount Baldy in Southern Cal and died. And overnight, he had a $100 million new burden to live with all by himself. Now you get to lead this company. And that is not easy to do. There's a word that's missing, by the way, in verse 6 when it says, be strong and courageous because you will lead these people to inherit the land. It's not translated in Hebrew because it doesn't translate very well. It's this sound. Go. All right. Me? Let me insert some reality here. Joshua, me? Them? Now? Raise your hand if you've ever felt you're in over your head. Sure. And this is a classic example of them. He knew. He had watched for 40 years. He had watched the lack of trust in the Israelites as they stood way back when, 40 years earlier, on the edge of the Red Sea. And Pharaoh's bearing down with he's closing in for the kill. And they're all going down that day. And he sees these people flip out. And he's thinking, man, I'm glad I wasn't in charge then. It'd be terrible. He remembered that well. And 3 days later, it wasn't like months later, 3 days later, there was no water, right? And remember what the people did? They just went nuts. And not to be too hard on those people. I mean, if I'm really thirsty and I'm living in that desert and I've been there, it's really kind of a scary moment. It brings out brown inside of your soul. And it was happening. And he remembered that. He remembered that there was specific rules given way back when. These people are going to be out there a while in the wilderness, and young Joshua watched as God said, look, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to provide manna, and here's a couple of manna rules. Every night, there will be manna brought to your tent site. Go outside your tent, get enough for that day, and nothing more. The second rule, on Friday, get enough for 2 days, because Sabbath is Saturday, and I don't want you breaking a Sabbath law, so you'll get two portions of manna. And they broke that as quickly as I would have broken it. Because if, you know, if a little quart works, how about a half a gallon of manna? And Moses stood there, and Joshua too, and saw this all go down. Joshua, in this moment, when he hears, you will lead these people, he has a flashback to God saying, how long will these people refuse to follow instructions? You cringe at that moment. If we're realistic here. And how could he ever forget the day that Moses was delayed up on the mountain, came down with the chiseled Ten Commandments and two tablets of stone and sees the people because of the delay. He loses his cool, throws the tablets to the ground because they had made a golden calf and they had switched up their gods and decided to go a different direction. Tough to lead. Ask anyone who's led a family, it's most of us, who's led a business, lots of us, a church, a platoon. The leadership list goes on and on, sports teams. Ask any of them and they will tell you it's hard to be in charge, really hard to be in charge. Not everyone salutes. Some challenge, some will even stand in your way. And can I say something about church leadership? Because we tend to idealize certain settings of leadership. I think it's the fiercest of all, and I say that not poor me, I say that because my Bible tells me that the devil wants to destroy everything in a spiritual setting. Amen? And so we get to lead, like you do get to lead at your business and all, and the devil is seething at the prospects that, you know, that a church will do the right thing and move forward. I know this about my setting of leadership, that the devil seethes and he resists and he resents every attempt to lead, because this is aimed at bringing God glory. Why would he want that? I hope you'll take time. I'm going to give you a suggestion right now. Read 2 Corinthians any chapter in 2 Corinthians today. And read it knowing that it's a letter written by the Apostle Paul defending his apostolic authority. You say, Paul was on the ropes? Yeah, he was. People were taking shots at him all the time. So chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, 10 through 13. 2 Corinthians is really a defense of his job. Now, I say that because I want you to appreciate the reality that leading is a difficult challenge. And so God doesn't just say, lucky few get to lead. God says, no, I'm going to be with you. And that's why, to a very, I think, sobered and shaken Joshua, God says to him, not once, not twice, but three times in a row, be strong and courageous. Would you look at verse 6? Again in verse 7, and then again in verse 9. Be strong and courageous. God repeats the theme. The size of the challenge will be huge, but I will be with you. And that's the key here. If you've got a take-home moment, here it is. You face something that's big and intimidating. You face something that has you in a role where you must lead. And I don't care where that is. I've given you some examples of your business or your home or another setting, or it doesn't matter, in military. That's hard to do. And God says, to do that, I want you to be strong and courageous. Ready for this? Comma. Because he says, after telling Joshua, be strong and courageous, be strong and courageous, be strong and courageous, he follows it, the comma, with, for I will be with you everywhere you go. Verses 5 and verse 9, check it out. I will be with you everywhere you go. In other words, Joshua, I'm not asking you to be something. I'm asking you to realize as you lead, with strength and courage, know I am with you to pull it off. Amen? That's the truth. And of course, we don't have time for this, but verse 8 tells, look, you need me. You need me on a daily basis, so be with God daily. That's my takeaway of verse 8. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night. And be with God daily always leads to obey God completely. That's why he says so. Verses 7 and 8. So how did you earlier when I asked the question, what is it that you face in your life? Finish the sentence. That you need strength and courage to get through, to lead well, to be successful and prosper. You now have your answer how to do it. I pray that God gives us the grace and the courage that we will need to be these things as we lead. I'd like you to bow your heads as we prepare to take communion together today.